It's February 16th, 2012. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show Season 2. This is best practices for fine living advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery.
Viva la vida.
Indeed. We've entered
season
2.
You didn't introduce yourself.
What's that?
You didn't introduce yourself.
I know, we've entered season 2, so I'm mixing things up. But yes, I'm Alan.
And I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you the Hell Yeah Show. This is episode 1 of season 2. We had 24 episodes in season 1. Can you believe that? You can listen to us for an entire day.
We had 24 and a half episodes. I did a special feature for you last...
And the amazing special feature, which I thoroughly enjoyed. That was fantastic.
I'm really glad.
That was,
great. It was mostly for your benefit.
So here's the thing, though. I've seen, I'd say, all but one of those episodes, if not all of those episodes.
Okay.
So it gave me a list of the episodes that I need to go back and watch, without a doubt. So.
Yeah, there's also in the future we'll probably do another show like that. But it's one of my favorites. I will talk about that Seinfeld stuff all the live long day.
Yes, indeed. And so if you haven't heard, you should go back and listen to last week's episode in which Emery and Liz take you through the best of Seinfeld.
So. Yeah, it's kind of a top five selections. And the full list is 10, and then we did them in chronological order.
Okay, yeah.
So you're getting the first half of the top 10, not necessarily the top five.
Okay, cool.
If that makes any sense.
No, it was great. It was a lot of fun to listen to, and now I am back in action this week. Last week was not a fun week. So,
how was your diorama?
The diorama went great. It's got it's got like a volcano, and there is a volcano in the diorama, working volcano.
That's awesome.
And yeah,
you have dinosaurs.
I took some Play-Doh and shaped it into some dinosaurs. And
wow,
yeah, I know. I had some cardboard cutouts of cavemen, and you know. That sort of stuff. Historically accurate, of course.
You know, as the kids say, picks or it didn't happen.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to the real stuff here. Emery, you jailbroke your phone again.
Yeah, I used to do it because I always had to change the SMS alert tones, and Apple didn't let you do that.
Yeah.
And now I just realized that I don't like the default system font, and so... I jailbroke just so I could change the font. But yeah, it's not something I do very often these days, but it's so easy to do now. It's not really all that difficult a thing, and then you get access to some pretty cool stuff, and why not?
Yeah, I don't know. I've not jailbroken an iPhone since the App Store came out. I jailbroke my phone. There was not a moment since the invention of jailbreaking that I hadn't had my phone jailbroken before the App Store came out. But then once it came out, it's like, okay, you know, this was all I really wanted for the most part out of jailbreaking. So, you know, there's a few things I can't do with apps from the App Store.
Yeah.
But generally, it fits my needs. So, I don't know.
Pretty awesome.
I'm okay with the system font, actually, surprisingly.
Yeah, I just wish I could change it just a little bit because I don't know what it is, but I just get a little annoyed with it. I don't know what it is. Like, it's not even that it's not like it's illegible or anything. It's a fine font. It's just I need to mix it up is really what it comes down to, I think.
Okay.
I can't have the same anything for too long.
That's what I was going to say. Also, you can't have the same anything as the person next to you on the train.
Yeah, screw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may have just nailed it right there.
Uh-huh. Anyway, okay. And then other items from this past week here?
Yeah. One of the projects I'm working on at work is using some open source software called OSEC HIDS, and it's kind of a host intrusion prevention and detection software. So it runs software on your computer, and then it monitors log files and critical system files, and then it makes notifications and sends you alerts when something has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So in the course of working on that, I'm working on some stuff with VMware. So I had kind of a really fantastic circular, I don't even know, it was a crazy adventure in recursion. I had I was starting up the VMware ESXi server inside a VM, running on my Mac Mini. And then I had a Windows 7 workstation VM also running on my Mac Mini, running the vSphere client to connect to and manage the ESXi VMware server that then also had VMs loaded so that I could experiment with the notices and messages that can come out of that and sending them into ESX to do interesting things. So,
really, this is what the future looks like.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's certainly, you know, people are making really strong use of virtualization, and it does have some different paradigms in terms of what your concepts are there. And I mean, I guess we can talk about this a little bit more later. But I mean, Apple is kind of also taking their entire business into this direction, not strictly virtualization, but certainly changing the computing paradigm. Google, same thing. Microsoft. I mean, everyone's kind of looking at it, you know, a little bit differently. So it is the times they are changing, as they say. But I'm also excited because we have we're going to have a special guest segment next week. A software developer who wrote something really cool, and we're going to talk to him and learn a little bit more about his project and why it's good. So I'm pretty psyched about that. Yeah, I think I mentioned on the special episode last week, the social network site Path, they had some flack over the address book uploading thing.
Yeah.
And then there's a really cool resource at the Wall Street Journal. It's in the show notes, and it's kind of like this privacy resources thing called What They Know. And it's basically not just like iPhone apps, but all sorts of like websites that track and monitor and like what they retain on people. And if you're curious about this kind of thing, like what actually is being, you know, stuffed into your permanent record, as it were, it's a pretty good resource for that. There's also a cool application released for macOS 10 either yesterday or today called Adios. And what it does is it essentially lets you man in the middle your transactions from your iPhone to various service providers. So you can run an app on your iPhone and you can see which applications are just chucking your address book up, you know, all over the place without asking you. And in plain text, in some cases, like you can actually monitor all of that and see what exactly. I mean, and you could do this anyways, but this Adios package makes it really easy to do. So that'll be interesting to see what happens from that. Like the Path people in particular, I mean, best practice for sending things like if you're a developer and you're trying to match an address or something like that, like you can create a hash of it, which is like kind of a cryptographic representation of the data that'll be consistent on both ends. And you send that up to match against other ones. And then you can just basically send a message back to the user software and say, I found a match, without actually having to know what the address was.
Right. And without having to transmit the address through the air, basically. Yeah.
And in some cases, that's really bad because, you know, like my incident in Boston, like if you think that you're not sending anything sensitive, in my case, it was sensitive enough just because it was a phone number.
Yeah.
And I normally would not consider my phone number to be sensitive information, but in this case, like someone snagged it and did something bad with it. And you know what's funny about that too is I was talking to my BFF about this, and he said, "Get this." He suggested that it's possible that in the United States, that, you know, like the whole text me stop to stop these messages thing. Yeah. I know that's like the deal, what you're supposed to do like in the UK, but I don't know if that's what you're supposed to do in the United States. And he suggested that maybe when I was sending stop, that was actually me, quote unquote, signing up for the service.
Because clearly, if you text back in all caps, stop.
Well, they don't care what you text them, because it's like, because he pointed out, like, you know, if you do like those fundraising things or you do like an American Idol vote.
Well, yeah, it doesn't matter what you text.
Yeah, you can send them like, you know, your mother's a whore, and you hit send, and then it's like, oh, thank you for your vote. Like, they don't care. And it's possible that like when I was sending stop and whatever, that like this was sufficient, like just basically signed me up.
Well, and if you're a scammer, you know, that's.
Well, yeah, clearly they don't get
it.
Anyway.
And if you can get away with that, yeah, of course you want to interpret stop as please send me more messages. So
yeah, I've been too busy. I need to get back on that and sue that dude. And then, you know, my friend Sean sent me a bunch of IMs tonight. We're trying to get ready. And I have like ding, ba-ding, 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 like a steady stream of messages. So I told him I'd ask. he has, I don't know what version of iPad he has, but he was wondering if he should sell his iPad now to buy the new quiet Xbox and then sell the Xbox that he has, and he has a Wi-Fi iPad. And then you were saying that never buying an Xbox on eBay, like, yeah, you don't want to do that.
Well, so, I mean, it's gotten better, right? But, like, first of all, it's, if you know, I'm assuming, so he says he has got an existing Xbox that's not a quiet Xbox. So that's probably the original Xbox, which had big hardware issues, got better toward the end of its life cycle. But that, not an original Xbox is in the non-360 Xbox, but original Xbox is in the Xbox 360 before they came out with the slim version of it.
Okay.
So, but I think it was last year, no, the year before last, they came out with the slim version of the Xbox 360, and it was much quieter, as he's saying. Also, it was more reliable on the hardware side. The original Xboxes were known for what's called Red Ring of Deathing. On the front, the power indicator would turn from green to red, and then it wouldn't boot, and you'd have to send it to Microsoft for repair. So apparently there were massive numbers of original Xboxes that did this. So there's two things going on here. First of all, the...
I'm sorry, I just keep laughing at the red ring of death.
Red ring of death, yeah. Like, it was...
It sounds like something you get when you go on a cruise line and have, like, bad clams.
Yes, indeed.
Sorry.
There's two issues here. One is that I'd imagine selling an original Xbox 360 is kind of tough because of the hardware issues. Probably possible. But also, generally buying, just because of the sorts of hardware issues that do occur, even in the new slimmer Xbox 360s, I do not recommend buying one used. The savings is not going to be that great. The savings is going to be like $50 or so, maybe. I don't think that's worth it for the potential hardware issues that you could encounter, depending on, you know, how that used Xbox has been treated, or even just when it was made and that sort of stuff. So. I think the best bet is to get the newest hardware revision, which is the stuff that's out now. I mean, they're continuously revising the hardware in the Xbox. So if you get one used, it's likely going to be the previous generation of hardware in the Xbox, even if it's still in the slim range.
So really what you're trying to do at this point is sabotage our friend Sean's chances of selling his Xbox.
Yes. I'm saying it will be difficult for him to both sell his used Xbox for a decent price and buy a used new a used more modern Xbox for a decent price. So basically,
I think he was going to buy the new one new.
Oh, then, oh, okay, okay.
And then he was trying to figure out if selling the,
the old one.
If it is worth doing it.
Yeah, no, I mean, if the old one is in good condition, if it hasn't red ringed, or if it, even better, if it did red ring and Microsoft repaired it, it's not like anyone's preventing him from selling it. I'm just saying that is not going to fetch the price that, obviously the newer revisions of Xbox, or that would have fetched a couple of years ago. So
I'm going to guess this is also like a first generation iPad, in which case he should sell it right now because the new one's going to come out.
Yeah.
And he'll be hard pressed, I think. I mean, it's not like the first gen. I mean, I've got the Rev A iPad too.
Yeah.
Or iPad also, I should say. But if I was really motivated, I'd probably be trying to sell it right now myself.
Yeah.
Just because I'm probably going to want the 3. Like, the only reason I didn't get the 2 is because it wasn't really enough. I mean, there wasn't enough of a CPU bump, and there wasn't a retina display.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not on the same timeline, but we're probably going to be seeing new Xboxes and new PlayStations within the next 2 years or so, which is, not that short of a timeline, but it does, consider that if you buy a new Xbox now, you might be replacing it with a next generation system within a couple of years. So
have they even announced? Has Microsoft even announced like their new next generation hardware?
No,
same with Sony.
No, I mean
Nintendo has, but that's it.
Yeah, the prevailing wisdom on this is it's always the person who's in trouble that goes first on new hardware, right? So actually, funny enough, Nintendo was the one that was in trouble because the Wii stopped selling. Everyone who was going to buy a Wii bought a Wii, and they sold a whole lot of Wiis, but then they didn't sell a lot of games for those Wiis, and they, you know, or services for those Wiis. So they've got to sell more Wiis, and at some point they can't sell more Wiis, so they need to come out with a new system. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just, I mean, oh, yeah. I mean, I love my Wii. I think it's,
yes.
I mean, I'm really looking forward to the new console, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so they move first, and that's perfectly reasonable, right? Because, as you know, as soon as people stop buying the current console, you want to come out with a new one, and or come out with some new thing, right? You know, like Microsoft had the Kinect for the 360, which has sold extremely well, and that's why Microsoft is in such a good position. That's one part of it, right? The Xbox is still selling really well. The Kinect is still selling really well. Microsoft is in a great position. Sony, not so much. You know, PlayStation 3 is selling, but not as well as it once was, and the PlayStation Move, their gesture control thing, is not the hottest product on the planet.
That thing sucks. It's terrible, and like, no one makes any software for it. Like,
right.
I have one, and it's like the one game that uses it is just terrible at it.
Right, right. So basically, it's you know, Nintendo has made their move. It's now Sony's move, because Microsoft is you know, probably not going to move until Sony moves, because they want to lay back, and you know, Sony comes out with something insane, they want to be able to match that. You know, they want to, you know, the person who comes last, who announces their thing last, is always going to have the advantage as far as you know, element of surprise goes. So yeah, I think Sony will move first, and that'll probably be within the next year or so, and then we'll see Microsoft move soon after that, and then we'll probably see new consoles within 2, maybe 3 years, something like that. So
you're familiar with the South by Southwest, right?
I am indeed.
Friend of the show, Jesse Chan Norris.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be presenting something really cool there, and he's a friend of ours, and he's a really cool guy. And his presentation, or his panel, or his discussion at South by Southwest is called "Going Beyond Digital Storage," and it's specifically about storing photographs, moving from kind of like the shoeboxes and albums into digital, and like what it means when you have your photos on Flickr and Facebook, and kind of discussing maybe more in a broader sense where your stuff is, and trying to kind of get a handle of that. I think it'll be really exciting and really interesting. I don't know. I've never been to South by Southwest, but this is probably a topic that I would consider going for, not just to support my friend, but
so. And do you know what track it's in? Is this in the technology track? Or
let's see here.
So now there's like 3 or 4 tracks to South by Southwest. I'm guessing it's not music.
yeah, I don't know. He's I mean, the link in the show notes will take you directly to his thing. It's about you know, like, it raises a lot of interesting questions too. Like, you take photos on your phone, and you know, like, if you've had a camera phone for years, you have like an old Nokia somewhere, and like a storage card. Like, what happens to that stuff in 50 years? You know, like,
right.
If you go to your great-grandparents' house and you're up in the attic, like, you can find photos that are, you know, from generations ago, and they're all kind of like in this format that people understand, whereas if you happen across a flashcard or, you know, like, there's definitely a disconnect when you digitize things. They become less real, but more accurate sometimes, if that makes any sense. So I'm not sure what direction it'll go in, but I'm sure it'll be exciting. And cool. if I don't go, I'll get to watch it online afterwards, I'm sure.
Yeah, nice. All right. I guess that anything else this past week?
No, had a really long week. Yeah. Nothing I want to talk about.
Cool. Yep. All right. Well, I had a few things happen. First of all, I moved from Media Temple to Rackspace.
Really?
For my web hosting needs. Yes.
Why Rackspace?
Well, so a couple reasons. So basically, I have an old Bluehost account, which I use for all the junky stuff, right? And then I use, you know, all my advertising rings and my my keyword spam sites and all that stuff. You know, all the stuff that you know, all my WordPress installations and the stuff that I don't really want to be meticulous about. And then I have had a server on a hosted virtual machine basically on Media Temple for the past few months, and it's not anything amazing. I think it's like 512 megabytes of RAM and 10 gigs of storage or something like that. But it's mine, and I've got root access on it, and I can tinker around with it, and I can be very meticulous about hosting the websites I care about, which is sort of my personal site and a few other sites that
Didn't your WordPress install get compromised a couple years ago?
Yeah. I mean, that was part of what motivated this, right? Is that like, yes, one of the WordPress installs I had on Bluehost got compromised. And, it's like that's what I mean by like the junk and the stuff I want to be meticulous about. Like when I started this Media Temple server, like everything is locked down. There's very little dynamic content on there. It's very much just for the sites that I really care about keeping very safe and very manicured. And also it's nice to have a machine that I can log into, and mess around from if I need to. So I hosted a Media Temple for a while, but the issue is they have this pricing plan that's the cheapest you can get is like $30 a month, and you get this dedicated machine for you. And that covers some amount of bandwidth and all that stuff. But I'm not using that much bandwidth. I'm not using that much storage. I'm a pretty low, I'm a pretty low frequency user of this stuff. It's just kind of there when I need it. So I wanted to switch to something that was, pay as you go, kind of adjusted to what I was actually using. Also, Media Temple's nearest hosting center is on the East Coast, and I am on the West Coast.
They have a data center in Los Angeles.
They have one in San Diego, but the type of server that I want, which is the one where basically they don't mess with it at all. They just give you a Linux installation. Mm-hmm. That type of server is only available at their East Coast data center. So anyway, switch to Rackspace because cheaper, because still very easy to set things up and manage, cheaper. Did I say cheaper? I think I said cheaper.
Yeah, you did. It's kind of a fringe case though. I mean, I have a server in the house that's accessible, and then I also have a machine in a co-location facility. I have an Xserve there, and then I have a Linode, which is basically a Linux OS virtual server that boots into a virtual environment somewhere, and that's one of the Hell Yeah servers lives there, and that's like where incumbent.org lives. So yeah. I have like kind of like my static stuff there and some email stuff, and
that's probably kind of equivalent to what I'm looking for.
And
here.
I like the Linode people a lot. The service has been really reliable and good, and they do native IPv6. So that's good for me.
Yep.
And then there's also the people that do my DNS, Gandhi.net.
Mm-hmm.
Love these guys.
I'm partial to Hover, but go ahead.
I understand. But Gandhi's great for a variety of reasons. They've just started launching, they have what they call a simple hosting service. So they have if all you want to do is run like a... like a very simple PHP and MySQL website, like a WordPress install, or that one website that I sent you to, the Zarf of the W, that doesn't really do anything yet, but has like some notes and stuff for the show.
Yes.
Yeah, that's running on that, and it's super cheap. And then they have another option coming soon that is for like static pages. So a lot of people are using things like Jekyll to create really nice websites, and they don't need any dynamic engine or anything. They're all just essentially static pages.
Yep.
So being able to kind of shove them into like a simple hosting thing like that might be the ticket for some people too. I mean, if you don't want to have to do anything with it. I mean, in your case, you wanted a little bit more control over it, but
well, yeah. And I want a machine that I can log into remotely and say,
reboot.
Yeah. No, I want a machine I can log into remotely and run like an IRC client on, or, or use it to SSH into other machines, or things like I want a machine that I can
gamut, right? Like I have, I mean, yeah. But, so the buying yourself an X server, a mini or something, and hosting it. Like, there's even like those mini colo, like MacMiniColo.net and a couple other ones where you can actually just like send them a mini and they put it in a rack. That's kind of cool. But there's a very wide spectrum that I think between the two of us in particular, that we represent all facets of that. Like, you know, we've got the home server, we've got the colo Xserve, we've got the virtual servers, and we got like the simple hosting stuff. But like Gandhi only charges for their PHP MySQL service. They're charging me $5.
That's $5 a month? Yeah, that's very solid. That's actually what Bluehost charges. That's less than what Bluehost charges me. So
yeah, and they give me 10 gigs of disk space, and I can have. They don't charge you by the site, so like they just charge you by usage. So like I have two websites on this thing, because I have the small size, and basically gives you like 300,000 page views a month is about how they're sized.
Yeah.
And it's really done by like the number of database connections that you have and the things that, unless you're a nerd, you don't really care about. So if you just have a very simple page, you know, it's really good for that and it's only $5. So, I mean, there's kind of, it's really good that these days you can find something that will do exactly what you want for just about any budget.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, even within services, I mean, I was on the basic tier of Media Temple, and now I'm on the basic tier of Rackspace. Both of those services scale up massively. So, if you end up with your website becomes extremely popular, you know, within a single service, you've got a variety of options for that sort of stuff. So,
way cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm enjoying that, and the migration was super simple. It was really easy, mostly because I knew where everything was, which is really great to know where all of the necessary files and configuration stuff is on your machine. That's always nice.
So did you have to like dial up with a modem?
Yes. Yeah, I plugged into the wall, and
AT, what is it? My AT command is like ATE1 V1 S10 equals 7, and that lets it when you get another phone call and the caller ID the call waiting beep comes, it'll knock you offline. That's the S10 register. You never had to do that, did you?
No.
Oh man.
All right. I was born with with a broadband line in my hand.
Wow.
No, I used dial up for a few years. So.
Oh. All right.
Anyway, other things that have happened this past week is I have gotten way into Sirius XM's Met Opera radio channel.
You have not.
Yeah.
You're just trying to justify the fact that you're too lazy and nice to call up and cancel.
I think I am. I like the idea of Sirius XM as a service, right? And I like some of their channels. So yeah, I think I do. I need a way to justify the fact that I'm paying them $15 a month or whatever. Actually, I think it's like 13, but, yeah, so I've gotten kind of, because it's great study music, it's like I throw it on in the background while I'm studying, and they do these live broadcasts, which are fantastic because they do, it's just the sound from the stage, and then in between it, they do interviews, they do, like critical analysis of the opera, all this stuff. So in the past week or two, I've listened to Götterdämmerung, the last of the Ring trilogies from Wagner, and I listened to Ernani the other day, as well as some other operas, and really enjoyed them. I don't see myself attending.
Do you enjoy the opera, or do you enjoy that maybe the people around you hear you listening to opera?
No. See, that is not the case, right? Like, I do not listen to it super loud. I'm not trying to be pretentious about it.
You're not trying to impress
anybody? Okay. No, and it's not actually that I so much enjoy the music itself. Although there are some times where I there's a really nice usually when it's like some catchy recurring theme, I kind of get behind that. But generally, I'm not that into the music itself. I'm more into the whole, the ambiance and it's a night at the opera house streamed to you live. They call it thrilling performances from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Directly to my speaker system. I like that concept. So, I don't know. I think, again, you know, you hit this right on, you hit the nail on the head here in that I am desperately looking for a way to justify subscribing to SiriusXM.
Ah, well, you'll figure it out. Yeah. It sounds like it's good. I mean, if you're enjoying listening to it, I mean, obviously it's, at least you're getting something out of it now instead of just kind of looking at it like, why the hell am I paying for this?
Yeah, yeah, there is that. And, you know, as I said, good study music, good for background, good for throwing on in the background. Anyway, but yeah, I do encourage, you know, you should sign up. You should sign up for like the
no.
They have like a 30-day trial.
No.
You should, yeah, you should.
Nope.
All right. Anyway, and then one final note here. I'm using Quicksilver again.
There's nothing better.
Oh my God, it's amazing. So
I cannot use a any computer without it. If I'm sitting down to like a
it's
Windows
crippling.
Machine or something, it's very difficult to not have that.
It's like you're available. Missing three fingers.
That's actually a really good way to put it. It's like not having opposable thumbs.
Right. Yeah. Quicksilver is this nifty little app for Mac OS X that is in its most basic sense a launcher. You press control space and you start typing something, and then when the thing that you want appears, you press enter and it shows up. But it's got a lot of other really nice features and nuances to it. And for a while, I thought, you know what, I want to minimize the number of things I have running at one time, so I'm just going to go with Spotlight, because it's already doing its indexing. I might as well take advantage of that. It does most of the same stuff, so I'm just going to use Spotlight.
Yeah,
and so for a long time, I just used Spotlight, and I guess I just didn't realize how terrible it was until I, in this past week, went back to Quicksilver and was just blown away.
Spotlight's not terrible, it's just... It's a very good search utility.
Yeah,
but
well,
it doesn't do half the things that Quicksilver does.
I guess what I mean is terrible as a launcher. As the kind of thing that Quicksilver is, as the kind of thing that I was trying to replace Quicksilver with, it was terrible. And I'd say the biggest issue is in Quicksilver, if you type, let's say, you know, let's say I'm trying to open TextMate, right? And I type T-E-X, right? In Quicksilver, if I've typed in TEX before and selected TextMate, TEX is always going to open TextMate. I type in TEX, no matter what I do, no matter how fast I type in TEX and press enter, Quicksilver is always going to do the same thing. In Spotlight, that behavior changes constantly. Yeah.
I mean, you can still pick different things that match, and you can still navigate it with, like, you know, Control N and Control P to like go up and down.
Right. You know, I'm saying as the type of thing that I was using Quicksilver for, I tried to use Spotlight for it instead, and I didn't realize how badly it was failing to do those things. So very
unfortunate,
happy.
Man. I feel bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Quicksilver is great because you can also do things like just put arbitrary text into the Quicksilver window and then send it to other things. Like you can make it append it to a file, or you can send it to a running application, or there's all sorts of actions you can do on things. It's great.
You can move folders. You can.
Oh, yeah. You can upload things, email them, compress them, like everything.
Yep.
It's basically a CLI for everything.
Yeah. It is fantastic. If you have a Mac, just install it, and you will never be able to live without it again.
You'll thank me later.
Exactly. All right. Speaking of OS X. Let's keep it general here.
Did you notice that they stopped calling it Mac OS X?
Did they really?
Yep.
It's just OS 10.8 Mountain Lion.
Yeah. The new OS that's going to be released this summer, Mountain Lion, is now called OS X, not Mac OS.
So you've got like iOS and then OS.
That's weird, huh?
Oh, that's so weird. I mean,
Apple Computer is now Apple Inc.
Yeah, but like they've claimed the term OS. I mean,
no, it's OS X. It's the name of the product.
Yeah, but then you get OS 11. You know, presumably they could go back to their roots and release an OS 2. You know,
no, that was System.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Oh, yeah.
OS 2 is IBM.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm aware of that. That was the point I was trying to make. But yeah, you are.
You've actually heard of OS 2, huh?
I have. Yeah. Oh. Anyway, but you know, that's what I'm saying. Like the thought of Apple claiming the term OS.
I don't think they're not claiming OS. They're just they're referring to the OS as OS 10
okay.
instead of Mac OS 10.
Because Mac is just no longer a thing.
Well, it is a thing, but it's they're separating it.
Yeah.
So Apple has never been an operating system company. That was always like the big distinction between Microsoft and Apple, is that Microsoft wanted to sell an operating system that ran on any computer.
Yeah.
Apple wanted to sell a computer or an entire user experience.
Yes.
It's a completely different business model. They were very different. I mean, you could look at one versus the other, and they were often compared, but they were two very different businesses, and they were trying to do two very different things.
Yeah.
And use different, entirely different means to get there. So Apple, the Mac OS, has always been a very strong face of Apple. Like, you know, the Mac is what makes Apple, Apple. But these days, it's not the only thing that Apple has.
Right. And well, and I pulled this, there was a statistic in a ZDNet article that Apple sold more iOS devices in 2011 than it sold Macs in 28 years.
Oh, crap. Are you kidding me?
No.
That is amazing.
That is so crazy that they would have gotten to that point. I mean, it's just iOS devices are so ubiquitous, and I guess Macs are not. I mean, it's kind of weird because you feel like Macs are ubiquitous too.
Oh, man. You know, seriously, like I look around. I mean, again, I'm on a university campus, right?
Yeah.
But like, I mostly see Macs everywhere.
Yeah. No, me too. Yeah. I mean, I'm on a university campus as well, so.
Yeah.
Who knows,
like, even.
But,
yeah, like meetings and everywhere I go.
Yeah. So, I mean, this statistic is staggering to think that there are that many iOS devices out there that, I mean, the 28 years of selling Macs versus 1 year of selling iOS devices.
They hit a record this week too, right? Their stock started trading over 500.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, and you know, it makes it very clear. It's like, yes, the you know, we're talking about Mountain Lion. I mean, the Mountain Lion is more of let's bring the stuff from the iOS devices into the Mac devices. Let's bring the good ideas from there back into the Mac. And that makes sense. I mean, because at this point, it's like the iOS devices are the things that people are familiar with, and it's like you're selling, you know. It's the old Halo effect, you know. They have the iPod, and you're selling them the Mac. You know, now they've got the iPhone, you're selling them the MacBook. So,
yeah, I feel like Apple's long-term strategy here is that, I mean, clearly their vision is that connectivity and content are ubiquitous.
Sure.
I mean, that's even the name of the Back to My Mac iCloud daemon that runs on every Mac.
What, connectivity?
It's called Ubiquity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the process and the API for iCloud and like how the Back to My Mac stuff works and like how your Apple ID can tie you to all of your stuff
no
matter where it is. It's called Ubiquity D or whatever. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And in your OS X keychain, you'll even see you have security certificates for Ubiquity. That allow you to authenticate against your content in iCloud or iTunes Match or any of these services to keep it encrypted. I mean, they're trying. So many people have like this notion like, you know, everything's going to be in the cloud and the cloud's great or the cloud sucks. But like what they haven't realized is that the way that Apple is leveraging it is that you can keep your stuff can exist in a place where it's safe and secure and that you can get access to it whenever you want and also have a copy of it locally. Like you don't have to have everything in the cloud. You can still leverage it for the things that it's really good at is what Apple seems to want to take you in. And it's like, you know, my iTunes library is far bigger than I could hold on my computer. And that's because my computer is a MacBook Air with an SSD.
which is probably, I mean, where things are heading, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, my entire iTunes library, if I just do music, is like, I don't know, it's like 120 gigs or something. So, you know, I'm not going to be able to fit that and my stuff on my laptop. But you know, I can have like, you know, some of my favorite playlists or the stuff I listen to most frequently. And because of things like iTunes Match, I can have that with me wherever I go. So, I mean, that's a really good use of that technology, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, and it looks like that, along with a couple other sort of broad strokes of let's take the things that really make sense given this multi-device lifestyle and put them into the sort of elements of the OS, you know, the basics of the OS.
Well, it's like Jesse's presentation about, you know, photos and like where your stuff lives. I mean, people don't want to have to figure out. It's like when Apple introduced the photo stream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's a really cool feature. I mean, a lot of people were kind of like skeptical of this, but I thought it was great because when you take a picture on your iPhone, like, you don't want to have to like remember you got to plug it in and then you got to sync it and you got to copy it over. Like, that's stupid.
Yep.
And like, and nobody wants to do that. And Apple's entire business right now is so heavily focused on the mobile side. I mean, you don't ever have to own a computer and you can still use everything that Apple makes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't even have to have a computer. I mean, you can go into a store.
That is a fairly recent thing, though. I mean, as of like maybe a year and a half ago, that was not the case at all.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the long-term goal here, though, is that not only if I lose my iPhone today, yeah, I can go to the Apple store, I buy a brand new one, I put in my Apple ID, and all my stuff comes back.
Yeah.
I lost nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And nobody else does that.
I mean, well, you could do it yourself if you really wanted to.
That's the whole point, is that you don't have to.
Right.
And you shouldn't and the whole thing being that, like, you know, you shouldn't have to be a full-time IT dude.
Yeah.
Just to keep from losing all your photos.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, you know, that type of having your stuff always be there. I mean, having like that's sort of a safety net, I think, is a huge win. And I think I really feel like part of me really wonders if eventually, I mean, I don't know how many revisions of OS X we're going to see. I mean, whatever comes next, you know, if it's OS 11 or if it's, you know, something else entirely. I mean, there are some people that think that like maybe Apple will move entirely to like, you know, the ARM architecture and large format iOS devices.
That would be such a shame, though. I mean, that, you know, because they make great laptops, like, that, you know.
what would be different? So they could still make. I mean, if you look at like a 13-inch MacBook Air,
yeah.
What if it just had an ARM CPU in it and it just happened to run iOS?
The first part, fine. ARM CPU, totally fine. The second part, iOS, unless it got significantly better for
that's just it
for some so, key tasks.
I think this is where they're taking it, though. I feel like. And I don't think that they're wrong for doing this. I think that it's where people want it to be.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, Microsoft is doing it too. I mean, Windows 8, that's what that's all about. So,
It's definitely where the industry is headed for whatever reason. And I think like some of like the screen sharing stuff that's been introduced and like being able to have multiple virtual consoles on OS X.
Yeah.
I think that is a feature that is made with iOS in mind so that you could connect to a semi-permanent, persistent OS X instance in the cloud from your iOS device. No.
I'm laughing because that would be, I like, it's surprising how close that scenario might actually be. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you would be able to, from any device, so like even from your phone, from your iPad, or from even your Mac OS X, like your iMac, if you had like this persistent session that you could constantly be working with remotely.
Everywhere.
Like, can you imagine how much easier your life would be?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as long as you had connectivity, all of your stuff was available at all times.
Yep.
And it never had to, you know what I mean? Like, it was always there.
Yeah. 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 And
instant
and,
on, you never had to maintain
all
it.
Integrated with itself. And it, you know, cause it's just one, it's just I mean, one OS. Yeah.
All of your stuff, like all of your devices are just like remote terminals. It's almost in a way, it's like going back to a 1980s Unix model where you have like these X11 servers, like these X consoles that are connecting to these very large and computing centers.
All you've got is a keyboard, basically. Yep.
Yeah. Exactly. Being able to kind of like take that sort of a transition, like, you know, going back to the future, as it were, in some ways. But at the same time, like, there's a lot of benefit to doing that. And I mean, some of the really cool stuff in Mountain Lion, they're letting it set. I mean, and they're going to catch a lot of heat for this. But one of the things that they're adding is like application signing and being able to require it. So you can set it so that you can have your machine so that you can run whatever you want. You can also have it so that you can only run the things, only run software and applications that have been signed by Apple. Or you can also set it to the highest level of security, which is that you can only run things that are published from the apps.
That better not be the default. Oh,
I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with it. I mean, it's still developer preview. I mean, who's to say?
Yeah,
but
no, we'll see.
I kind of like this idea though, mainly because, I mean, I'm in a situation where I have to deal with compromised machines all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, having some sort of a trust relationship with the software would go a long way to helping that. I think
it would certainly
inspire more confidence in the platform, and not that OS X is known for viruses or anything, but there is something to be said for having, like, you know, this software is inspected by inspector number 5.
Sure.
You know, like, yeah. That sort of a thing. And like, mobile phone environments and ecosystems, like the Nokia Series 60 platform, like, they, for years, you had to have signed software. And then they, you know, started letting you, if you had like an unlocked handset with no vendor customizations, then you could run whatever you wanted to, or run self-signed ones, but it was always kind of a pain in the ass. Like, I think that people saw the benefit of it, but were not able to deliver it. And yeah. I think
the App Store is, you know, is a very, not the App Store on Mac, but the App Store that people are familiar with on iOS is a very good example of why that sort of thing works.
Yeah.
So,
wow, what a great
what's
topic.
That?
Well, what a great topic. I mean, this is going to be a really exciting thing. I think I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah, and so if you have not seen it yet, there are plenty of previews and investigations into 10.8 Lion out there. We've got one linked in the show notes that Engadget did, but it is all over the place right now.
And if you're running Lion now, you can already get a beta preview of Messages for Mac OS X, which is going to be standard in Mountain Lion. I'm running it on all my Lion machines now. It lets you do iMessage, which is like the iPhone to iPhone text messaging and video chat.
Yep.
You can do that now inside your Mac. So this is great because I don't like when I'm at my desk and like my phone vibrates and I have to like go fish out my phone and then send someone a message back.
Yep.
Now you can get those text messages. They show up on your iPad, on your iPhone.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, and then you can respond using your full keyboard, and it's pretty convenient. And you can also still use, you know, your Jabber services and things like that. So, like, now I have one little application that does my text messaging, my video chat, my Facebook chat, my iChat AV stuff, my old iChat. It's great. And
yeah.
I suggest people check it out. It's pretty cool.
All right. Well, in slightly less Apple positive news, however, we'll talk about it. But the Kindle Fire has stolen some tablet market share.
Has not.
From the iPad, according to statistics.
That's all right. Kindle Fire's cool. I mean, people like it.
No, it's great. It's great. I don't think this is as dramatic as it seems, but Apple's share of tablet sales dropped from 64% last year to 57% this year, and the Kindle Fire now has 14% of the tablet market. I don't think this is a big deal because I think the people who are buying the Kindle Fire would not have bought iPads instead of it. I mean, it's a different price range.
No.
It's a different, you know.
Yeah, different service, different device, different philosophy, and I think, the Kindle Fire, if it's hard to argue with the value proposition of Amazon Prime streaming.
Right.
Like, I mean, if you have a Kindle Fire and you've got the Amazon Prime account, like, you're pretty set for entertainment, right? Like, no, I'm serious. Like, what's not there? I mean, you can get HD everything. I watched an episode of Arrested Development in high def on it last week. I thought it was great.
Wait, you have a Kindle Fire now?
No, on Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay, all right.
If I was going to get a Kindle, I'd get the one you've got, I think.
Yeah, the one I've got is fantastic. Just the baseline one, but with no ads. Oh,
yeah.
It's fantastic. And the leather case that costs like $60. But yeah.
Anyway. I had someone last week send me on the Twitter machine. They were like, "I'm really mad at you now because I listened to the episode from last week and I started watching Storage Wars and I can't stop."
Oh my god, Storage Wars! Everyone, if you are listening out there and you have not yet watched Storage Wars, you can get it online. There are Netflix and Amazon Prime, and you can find it online. You will find it online. You will go and watch at least one episode of it. And by at least one, I mean you will watch one and then you will watch all the other ones.
And have no idea why you're doing it.
And have no idea why you're doing it. Or really, I mean, you will hate yourself throughout the entire experience.
Yeah. It's just nothing but drinking yourself to oblivion and watching Storage Wars.
That is the life.
So glamorous.
Yes. Speaking of things that are love-hate relationships, here we go.
Oh, what's that I hear? Hark.
That's soothing, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty nice.
That is the sound of a wild PlayStation Vita.
You know what was really cool about that?
Yeah.
And just to kind of, as a preamble here, I mean, I was upstairs, and I was hanging out, and I was working on my laptop, and I heard some music from The Legend of Zelda, which is my ringtone.
And
I was like, "Oh, who's calling?" And I looked down, and it was you. And it was a FaceTime call, and I was so excited.
Me. Yeah.
And then you actually got to do like kind of a hands-on demo of the PlayStation Vita over FaceTime, and Liz and I were watching. It was really cool. I had a lot of fun with that.
That's
great.
That's good. Yeah, no, it worked surprisingly well once I was near a Wi-Fi hotspot for a decent amount of time. And I was able to show off some of the features to you. I also told you the story that I'm about to tell our listeners about signing up for an AT&T data plan.
Oh.
And there was one detail I left out. So let me recount this here. So the Vita has a 3G feature, like apparently all mobile devices do now, and I've got the 3G version, and so I thought, you know what, if I'm ever going to use the 3G on this thing, it's going to be within the first month of owning it, because that's when I'm going to be most excited about it. That's going to be when I'm bringing it everywhere with me. You know, that's going to be the time to buy the 3G, right? So I went ahead and I figured I'd get a month of 3G service to try it out, see how it works, that sort of stuff. So on the device, well, first of all, I connect the device to campus Wi-Fi, right? And the whole experience with this device has been just it doing terrible things and me still kind of liking it. So I connect it to campus Wi-Fi. And it can't get a connection because I need to go through an authentication process and enter its MAC address into a system. And identify it with my campus's residential computing authority.
Mm-hmm.
So it connects to campus Wi-Fi, and then it's like, no, I can't do anything, and it just stops. And I'm like, well, I need a MAC address. Can't find the MAC address. Can't do anything. I go back. There's no way to switch to a different network. There's no way to do anything. I'm now locked into selecting the campus Wi-Fi network.
Oh no.
So I'm like, okay, fine. You know what? I was gonna sign up for 3G anyway. I'll go ahead and sign up for 3G. So I go through that process. I get to it opens a web browser, and I get to this page, and there's in super small font, it says network error OX and then like a hex code. It's like, great, yeah, you're doing well, Vita. This is a good first 5 minutes.
The out of box experience is really paying off.
Yeah. So then I back out, and there's actually this way to go, you know, oh, I don't have an internet connection, I'm just going to do a local thing. So I do that, get into the device, find the MAC address, register on the network, all that stuff, come back to it later. I go, okay, you know, I actually do want to sign up for the 3G, to see how that works. So I go through this process. I open there's like a, you know, AT&T app on it that's actually not that intrusive, so that's okay. I open this up, and it's like, okay, sign up for a data plan. So I click this. It opens a web browser, the built-in web browser, opens up to this carrier page clearly supplied by AT&T, which has no indication of whether it's a secure page or not. And asks me to enter all of my account details, which it's, you know, I'm creating a new account here, so I'm entering my credit card information, my billing address, my phone number.
Wow.
Yeah. So I go through all this, I enter all this information.
Oh, of course you did.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course I did. This is the best part. I get to the end of this form and I submit it. And oh no, first of all, I set the Vita down for a second to go check something else. The screen turned off because it timed out after a minute. I come back to it, I turn the screen back on, and the entire form is wiped clean.
Of course it is.
Yeah. So then I fill out the form again, submit it, and something is wrong with it, right? Like I forget what field it was, but one of the fields I didn't fill out correctly. So there's a little notification about that. And I go down, and everything in the form is preserved except for the three checkboxes that I have to uncheck in order to unsubscribe from all of the like AT&T spam emails. So they've rechecked those boxes for me, which is great. Thank you, AT&T. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Nice.
So then I go through all that. I sign up for the data plan. I'm sure some hacker that was sitting outside my dorm has all my credit card information now. Now, I've got a 3G connection. So,
wow.
Yeah.
What a convoluted route you've taken.
Anyway, yeah. Oh, it was a terrible out-of-box experience. It was just like atrocious. It was the first half an hour with the device was just nonstop awfulness. I still kind of like it. I was telling you earlier, it has probably the slickest multitasking interface I have used. It is just super, super responsive. It's switching between apps, closing apps that you don't want to remain in memory. That sort of stuff is just really smooth. And part of it's probably this thing has got some mega processor in it and graphics card and all that stuff, so it can do all these crazy effects and transitions and all that sort of stuff. But it's just really smooth. It's smooth in a way that I did not expect it to be. It is probably more responsive than an iPhone, which is pretty impressive. So
that is really impressive. I mean, like from what you were showing me too, it was definitely very quick at handling any user input element.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, it was just cruising.
Definitely. And then the other thing is this thing plays games, which. are presumably a large part of the device, but which is kind of easy to forget given the trappings of this thing. I'm looking at the first page of icons, and none of them are games.
Does it do the PlayStation Play thing where like if you have a PS3 you can kind of like remote into it with that device and then play videos and stuff?
It does. You can play videos.
Because the PSP does that.
Yeah, you can presumably play some games as well. But I don't know that the support for that is there quite yet. There's definitely the integration with the PS3 is there. I was able to transfer some save files and some already downloaded PSP games and that sort of stuff. So that all does work.
That's cool.
I've downloaded one game, which is Hot Shots Golf World Invitational, which is actually more fun than it sounds. there's the Uncharted Golden Abyss, which I downloaded the demo to, and it looks very, very sharp. Very graphically impressive. I wasn't that impressed by it's still an Uncharted game, which is great. I like Uncharted games, but it's kind of an Uncharted game without the really ridiculous Uncharted things you get on console. There's no, like, from what I've heard, there's no train scene. There's no, ship capsizing. There's no, it doesn't ever reach that really amazing sense.
It's not
of
a
scale.
Crescendo.
Yeah, that you get in a console Uncharted game. But then I've been messing around with, there's this welcome park thing.
Ugh.
that I was telling you about earlier.
That's really bumming me out.
That it's a bunch of tutorials on how to use like touchscreen and how to use the camera. And how to use this thing has actually a back touch screen, so you can touch both the front and the back of the device, and it receives both of those both those inputs. So there's all these tutorials on like how to do that stuff, and they're completely unremarkable. They're not fun to play through, but they give you PlayStation Network trophies for completing some of these tutorials and for doing well in them. So
oh, really?
Yes. you sound so surprised. Yeah, so I've been going through those, and actually these what are completely inane games, like tap all the numbers in the correct order, actually turn into somewhat engaging experiences when you tell someone, and by the way, you have to do this in 20 seconds. And those, I mean, it actually gets rather hard. So that stuff has been interesting. It, you know, again, it's like it's these things that are terrible, right? It's like these really bad tutorial mini games and this really bad AT&T data signup process. It's just like all these things that should be telling me that this is not a wonderful new piece of technology. But you know, it's kind of slick. I don't know.
I think it sounds pretty cool. I mean, I like the form factor.
Yeah, it's
of the device.
Screen is gorgeous. The screen is amazing. It's really, really massive and really sharp. So,
I forgot to mention earlier. This is actually kind of a big deal. There's a piece of malware that is specifically designed to it targets financial and banking information. Hmm. It's called Zeus. Been around for a while. There's a derivative of it that got open sourced into a package called Citadel. It is a
you know what Zeus is.
I know who Zeus is.
Is it Z-U-S-E or is it Z-E-U-S?
Z-E-U-S.
Oh, that's too bad.
But
Z-U-S-E, like, is a Tron character, and I think that would be a great name for a piece of malware.
That would be a pretty great name for a piece of malware. But yeah, it's kind of it's been a pretty substantial one. I mean, people use it to inject fake. What it does is it essentially acts as a man in the middle when you go log into your bank. So if you have this running on your computer, you would never really know. And the entire session gets replayed and stolen so that you're feeding your passwords and stuff into a remote system somewhere. Which is really dangerous, but the code was released a few years ago, or I want to say it's like 2 years ago, and there's this new package called Citadel, and it's essentially an open source project now. So as new exploits for things are being discovered all the time, they are ending up pretty easily, can be weaponized and rolled into new versions of this malware, because it used to be that you had to pay money to get it. Like the people that wrote this would actually sell it for thousands of dollars.
Wow. That's real sketchy. Huh?
Oh, it has like a full, no, if I should, I could talk about this on another show, but, the short version is you actually get like a really nice management console for all of the compromised machines that you're controlling.
Wow.
And it's like a pretty nice like web front end, and you can see all of the people who are running your malware and like, when they log into their banks and stuff, and it's like siphoning off their information to you, and it was big business.
Wow.
And then it kind of like split into like two different projects, and one of them released the code and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of fuzzy as to like who did what to whom, but the code for one of these derivatives is now essentially an open source project. So probably going to be some pretty sketchy things that come out of that. So heads up.
All right.
Make sure you've got your antivirus software.
Cool. And on that last minute note of caution there, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show, the first episode of Hell Yeah Show Season 2.
Season 2 is going to be a great season, Alan.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm waiting for, I think Season 4 is really when we hit our stride.
Will that be our breakaway season?
Yeah. all right. Well, anyway, that'll do it for this episode. You can contact us at show@hellyeah.com. You can visit our website at show.hellyeah.com.
Or on the Twitter machine, twitter.com/hellyeahshow. Send us a tweet at hellyeahshow.
All right. Very good. And as you are all playing with your Vitas, we will see you next week.